Hello, everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. In this episode, we are pleased to be able to share with you the 2021 Egon Guba Memorial Lecture entitled Speculative Experimentation in Methodological Pluriverse by Dr. Mirka Kuro, with responses from Dr. Aaron Kuntz and Dr. Juha Swaranta. Mirka Kuro is a professor of qualitative research and director of doctoral programs at the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College of Arizona State University. Mirka has been an active member of AERA, the Qualitative Research SIG, and Division D since 1999. Her scholarship operates in the intersection of methodologies, philosophy, and sociocultural critique, and her work aims to contribute to various methodological practices and innovations, conceptual experimentations, and theoretical connections across various traditions and practices associated with qualitative inquiry. She is especially interested in creative and situational practices, critical and post-processes, diverse extensions of traditional methodologies, and how to conduct scholarship that is conceptually engaging, but at the same time can make a difference and carry possibilities for transformation and sustainable change. She has over 100 peer-reviewed publications in methodological and educational journals, and she is the author of Reconceptualizing Qualitative Research, Methodologies Without Methodology, in 2016, the co-editor of Disrupting Data in Qualitative Inquiry, Entanglements with the Post-Critical and Post-Anthropocentric, from 2017, and co-editor of Intrapublic Intellectualism, Critical Qualitative Inquiry in the Academy, from 2021. Dr. Aaron Kuntz currently holds the Frost Professorship of Education and Human Development at Florida International University. Dr. Kuntz's research focuses on developing materialist methodologies through engaged deliberation with critical theory, relational materialism, and post-structuralism. Dr. Kuntz's publications appear in a diverse array of research and methodological journals. In 2015, Dr. Kuntz published his first solo-authored book, The Responsible Methodologist, Inquiry, Truth-Telling, and Social Justice, in Routledge Press, which was selected as honorable mention for the 2017 Qual-SIG Book Award. Dr. Kuntz's latest book, Qualitative Inquiry, Cartography, and the Promise of Material Change, also from Routledge Press, was awarded the 2020 Outstanding Book Award from the Qualitative SIG at AERA. Dr. Juha Swaranta is currently professor of adult education at the University of Tampere in Finland. Dr. Swaranta has published extensively in the fields of education, political sociology of education, radical adult education, critical media education, and critical pedagogy. He has published studies on the methodology of social sciences, public sociology, and critical pedagogy. In all these fields, using sociological imagination to illuminate and solve problems that worry people and to promote social justice. Dr. Swaranta has published widely in academic journals and has authored or co-authored 38 books, which have been published in English, Finnish, Estonian, Greek, Norwegian, Spanish, and Portuguese. We're excited to welcome Dr. Kuro, Dr. Kuntz, and Dr. Swaranta to join us today on the podcast.
Welcome. Tervetuloa. Thank you so much for the invitation to do this fabulous honor. I would like to acknowledge the land where I'm currently living and working here in Phoenix and the original Hohokam caretakers of the land. And I am really, really grateful for the Egon Guba Award Committee and you, Jessica, as a SIG chair and executive committee for this amazing honor and opportunity to share my thoughts with you. Despite my potentially youthful appearances and my love of apocalyptica, I have a somewhat lengthy past with the qualitative inquiry. And let me just put my timer on so I don't take too much time. Aaron and Juha, who are my stimulating discussants today, and Egon Guba, especially the paradigm dialogue, we are really entangled in many ways in our past and hopefully in our experimental and philosophical inquiries of the future as well. It was 1999 when I attended my first AERA, heard amazing talks, and I also met Egon and Ivana. At that time, I attended my first qualitative research business meeting and thought to myself how excited I was about qualitative inquiry. Since then, I have worked with many of you, and that's why this talk is very exciting and emotional to me, because we have a lengthy past. For example, with Aaron, since 2000s, Aaron's work on methodology, Foucault, philosophy, ethics, and responsibility has been very intellectually engaging and provocative to me. My entanglement with Juha, in turn, they go even farther in the linear time. I met Juha during my master's studies, and he introduced me to the world and practices of qualitative inquiry. His critical scholarship, philosophical knowledge, work with Freire's legacy, and intersecting lines of methodology are truly inspiring. Mahtavaa, että olet täällä tänään, Juha, ainakin videon välityksellä. Entangled narratives, shared professional histories, paradigm dialogues, and multiple matter, often within the factory and working class town of Tampere, Finland, meeting rooms of Squick in Athens, Georgia, endless sunlight and scented orange blossoms of Phoenix, Arizona, come together today. I have multiple titles for this presentation, yet all of them are quite inaccurate. As you can tell, I deliver the talk with much speculation and hesitation. My methodological wanderings will not have core components or clear argumentative logic. The talk might not even offer anything new, especially if one considers the relational nature of knowing and situatedness of being simultaneously historical, already here, and always multiple. Light encounters, in turn, have everything and nothing to do with my presentation today, even though the talk is designed to be light in its effects. Dizzy, requesting a little effort, having a little weight, and move away from an inner light and truth, and maybe something that informs, ignites, and sparks. I hope this talk may offer some provocations, and maybe something I will say or do will enable you to enter the difference, feel effect, sense, and live the methodological light or lightness and darkness differently. Access alternative spaces through unthought connections and different ways to work through and live realities of inquiry methodologies and qualitative relations. Now I would like you to close your eyes. Take a little break. And what methodologies becomes possible? I wonder about potential and possibility embedded in speculation and speculative practices in a methodological world where many worlds fit. Some of my thoughts today are prompted by the way I live and experience qualitative inquiry as contemporary reflection, mirror, and actor in our complex and political global world. Methodologies create my field and sustain my career. Therefore, I wish not to give up methods or trample methodologies to the point of their complete non-existence. I need methods to do my work and pay my bills. Yet, this does not mean that my methods and your methods are the methods of positivism or post-positivism. I expand and revision past and current methodological practices, framing, discourses, and theories shaping the inquiries of today. Something important is also said about the dialogical and educational value of methods and methodologies, especially in the context of colleagues and scholars from other disciplines and frameworks. Knowing that inaccuracies and insufficiencies are always embedded in all concepts, including methods. Many qualitative scholars are excited about opportunities related to experimentation, theoretical connections, ontological freedom, justice, and ethical orientations research can offer. We have been inspired by the posts of materialism's more than human movements. We showed that qualitative research is indeed needed and driven by practice and can create different knowledges and knowledges differently. Recently, the field has experienced ontological and relational turns, paying more attention to the ecologies of life and inquiry. However, some of my excitement has been tamed by the artificial theoretical boundaries, conceptual regulations, standardized citation practices, maybe overly descriptive guidelines, and other political ways to monitor experimentation processes. Occasionally, I find myself mourning for more liberatory practices, worlds within the world that stay open and welcoming, hopefully in infinitum. Yet I'm truly inspired by the visible and hidden potential, more inclusive vision and unthinkable hope for qualitative inquiry as a methodologically pluriverse community. This talk includes interrelated flows of relationality, including speculative, experimentative, methodological, and plural flows. Speculation offers opportunities for creative imagination, hesitation, reflective questioning, and thinking with unthinkable futures. Experimentation reminds us that much of the qualitative research is crafted in shifting practice, in artistic relations, and within different and internationally creative, intentionally, internally creative and active time-space matterings. Responsible methodologies and methodologists, for example, think with Aaron, are needed with current methodological when current methodological practices need to be radically revisioned. Pluriversity and pluralism, in turn, are thoughtful choices toward more collective care and ecological diversity. Finally, all these relational flows ask for open-endedness and creative potentiality embedded across our ecological and relational systems and practices. I'd like to also share with you some of the examples of my work that bring together methodologies, experimentation, speculation, and plurality. Some years ago, Bodhi Lahr's work prompted me to consider how the science of reality created a duplication, a virtuality, hyperreal, which made it impossible to separate true and false, real and imaginary data, matter, and concepts. Bodhi Lahr helped me to see that objects and data can have their escape strategies and resistance. For example, during my qualitative research method courses, and many of you know this example, students produced virtual and hyperreal data. They ate their interview transcripts and documented the possibilities and impossibilities outside Cartesian dualism. Collectively with my peers, I sensed methodologies and processes in the dark, rainy forest. The sound moved me towards more than human and beyond singular and humanistic dialogues. Academic conference machine took over my international collaborations. And with my crazy gang, what we call us, we willingly allowed tables, dolls, gorillas, pacifiers to take over and participate our becoming and knowing. Materiality produced us slowly but steadily. Relationality heavily guided our collective thinking doing and enabled us to sense the world around us and think in action. The academic conference machine and its striated spaces and regulatory intellectual organization created disturbing effects, and we saw this machine as a reliable, regulatory, structured organizational space, a space of repetition, running the risk of becoming even more regulating, normalizing, and standardizing. We had to conference otherwise. Following the practice of Delman and colleagues, who encouraged scholars to make the familiar strange, listening Norman Denson's from 1970 proposal that sociological imagination should shape methodological thinking and practices, and more recently being inspired by imagination and performance philosophies, my qualitative methodologies are restless and shifting. Instead of focusing on conceptual independent singularity and practical linearity of a methodological past, seemingly fragmenting thoughts and acts are united through the concept of poly, the multiplicity of methodologies across different flows. In my recent work on navel gazing, my collaborators and I started thinking about research assumptions and practices that we keep hidden. This led us to think about navel gazing as one of the practices of excessive focus on self, true reflection, self-plagiarism, and self-citations. We laughed at the idea of looking at one's navel, but we decided to try it and later discuss the experience, theoretical and methodological insights, and silly recordings in our philosophical conversations. The proximity of navel created an interesting paradox. Navel, including also scholarship, knowledge, truth, reality, practices, etc., became intimately connected to the physical body of the researcher. But at the same time, it was acknowledged that navel is rarely seen, closely inspected, and infrequently deep cleaned. With my current students, we have also problematized stuck, unstuck subject as a speculative matter. In that context, speculative and radical imaginative approaches shaped our relationship to the formation of a methodological subject and its politics. The speculative subject, including future educator, subject sounds, language-less interviews, were explored through the communal processes, practices, senses, and sense-based awareness. Finally, with my interdisciplinary ASU colleagues, we develop a pedagogical activation lab, designing the pluriverse. The pluriverse aims to decolonize the epistemic Eurocentrism, racism, and sexism that guide academic practices and knowledge production in the Western universities. The aim for our lab is to share experimental exercises and activations that might take a form of provocation prompts and other strategies initiated by artists, scholars, designers, educators, that will intervene on the crisis brought about by the hegemonic design of Western universities. All right, then about a little bit about the experimentation. Some years ago, I wrote about methodologies without methodologies, about methodological spaces without faces, names, and predetermined strategies and categories. I was interested in methodologies with inaccuracies and defects, abnormalities. At the same time, my methodological dilemmas addressed by insufficiency of language, methodological non-imagination, inflexibility, theoretical and methodological difference. Now my breakdowns are more relational and material. Novely Gotchanis reminds us about scary and lonely world without others, specters of difference, and the cruel and toxic identitarian politics. Now I see more clearly the vitality in pluralism, caring, and sharing communities, and perceive the endless becoming of many. Worlds within the world, methodologies within methodologies, researchers within researchers. In other words, the multiplicity and methodological pluriverse are the worlds I want to talk about. I also argue that for us to live the plural and many, also plural and many methodologies, we have to imagine. Qualitative inquiry is not a world without a difference, and it's often conceptualized as the other, multiple and diversified. However, the discourse of difference can also be problematic, since it's often guided by dualism and hierarchization, leading towards methodological paracase, partition, ontological erasure, and epistemological colonization. Furthermore, from the perspective and paradigm of difference, one can also more easily locate and narrow down the toxic methodological other, simultaneously forming master subject and methodological narratives. I think it is important to remember that perceived methodological differences are not natural, but constructive. For Whitehead, Adventures of Ideas illustrate slow drifts of mankind towards betterment and civilization, a historical movement of adventures of framing and explanations of influencing history, not only the Western history, but the history of all humans and non-humans. Wanderings about many possibilities of theory, shaping inquiries, thinking beyond the thinkable methodological practices, and countering existing practices can be really super generative. Methodological language has rarely been correct and accurate, and more importantly, methodology has rarely been independent from other processes. Additionally, methodological processes have always had drifts, movements, and other own collective histories, potentially without causal and individual history or necessary linear logic. Thinking with thought pragmatically, guided by transformation, application, practice, have produced a series of experiments in my work, including experiments with text, language, discourses, concepts such as data, slowness, deduction, academic conference scene, and so on. I practice methodologies while simultaneously recreating, reshaping, reformulating the world we collectively live with and within. Methods do not order or predict the world, but they create emerging sense of worldly events. Erin Manning noted that, quote, thought must not be mapped onto practice. It's an emergent, incipient tendency to be discovered in the field of activation of practices composing. To map thought in advance of its speculative propositions would diminish the force of the study and reduce the operations to the status of creation of false problems and badly stated questions. Speculation offers multiple strategies to think beyond the known, recognizable, and predictable. Speculation slows down and forces us to think about alternative scenarios and the difference. It does not take anything for granted, and it's fueled by adventure. Since 2007, speculative scholarship has taken many turns. Speculative materialism, Harman's object-oriented philosophy, Krant's neo-vitalism, Bennett's vital materialism, Barat's agential realism and Whitehead's process philosophy are just a few examples. In many ways, speculation offers a response to a slow, hesitant, complex, and uncertain world of methodological multiplicity and diversity that many of us live in and hope to acknowledge in our scholarship. Speculative scholarship is tentative and too rather impossible to repeat, teach, or describe because language always fails. Our world is rapidly changing and we can no longer predict the most suitable methodological futures. Like any theory, speculative theories are meaningless if they do not enable scholars to experiment and figure out things in the world. According to Weissman and Gondorf, theory inhibits the gap between sensing and sense-making. It's a guess, a set of speculations of how to ethically and politically understand what we experience. Weissman and Gondorf exemplify speculation through forensic architecture, which builds on the split of the second as a durational and lethal concept. Duration and spatial coordinates of the split of the second are in the continuous flux of matter, actions, and meanings. The indeterminate nature of the split of the seconds makes this time-space lethal and extremely dangerous, since it reveals the larger picture which unfolds with this molecular scale of time. A split of second also functions as a zone of endless exceptions. In addition, Weissman and Gardoff offers us metaphorical concepts as concepts that express the entanglements of matter and meaning within specific time-space frames. Speculation may also offer alternative ways of life beyond academic capitalism, rigid citation indexes, and tenure clocks. Bella Casa referred to the caring as a speculative mode. Methodologies that speculate also wonder, that they don't verify, offer fixed solutions, pretend to understand the other and the different. Instead, they care, connect, and create educated guesses and various scenarios of possibility, building on exploratory, imaginative, and visionary powers of speculation. Speculative philosophy has the irreducible aesthetic dimension also. It requires new, bold inventions rather than pacifying resolutions, Savira explains. Savira writes that aesthetic includes feeling of the object for its own sake, beyond the legitimacy, usefulness, and interpretation. Aesthetics of a method offer effective potentialities through their relation and senses. More things are felt and sensed than known. Methods are a matter of degree, and the world of methods is the world of experiencing relational differences. What happens to methods when the observer, individualism, and capitalism are being removed? Maybe alien phenomenology following Bogost could offer some examples. Bogost draws attention to the strange relational life of non-humans, which could be analyzed through units, lists, excessive betweenness, configurations, and nonlinear patterns. For example, when we can eliminate likeness in human terms, we may be able to attain the innerness of things of unnameable units. What is it for the bat itself? Savira also encourages us to speculate about things and experiences that we cannot access directly. Touch can be felt, but not necessarily known. Every instance of beauty is something new.
The Qualitative Research Special Interest Group was established in 1987 to create a space within the American Educational Research Association for the discussion of ethical, philosophical, and methodological issues in qualitative research. We invite you to consider joining the Qualitative Research SIG today. For members of AERA, the annual fee for joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group for regular non-graduate student members is $10, and the annual fee for graduate students is $5. As members of the QR SIG, you will gain access to a network of fellow qualitative scholars, as well as our many activities, ranging from mentoring opportunities to our podcast series to updates and news related to recent qualitative publications and jobs. Please visit the American Educational Research Association's website at www.aera.net to join the Qualitative Research SIG today.
Just checking, 5 minutes left. Okay, let's do take another break and do a speculation, a provocation number two. Travel with the light beam in your home, office, or current workspace. Where does it take you? What methodologies could be added and subtracted? I advocate to a methodological multiplicity in the worldly and experimental ways. The world of multiple words, pluriversity, is not an ontological project, but the project of practice. Escobar's vision of pluriverse, following Sebastian's concept, a world in which many worlds might fit, oscillates between the politics of the real and the politics of the possible, between pragmatism and utopianism, says Escobar. Cultural, ecological, and methodological transitions characterize methodological movement within the pluriverse. In addition, this kind of methodological pluriverse takes into account biophysical, human, and spiritual elements. Diverse justices, matterings, and forms of critical quality inquiry offer new and alternative imaginaries. Mikol proposes that pluriversity is not a cultural relativism, but the entanglement of several cosmologies connected today in power differential. In methodological pluriversity, methods and methodologies do not function as independent units, but they are entangled through networks and continuously emerging connections. One schema for methodological organization and design is no longer sufficient, and different methodological approaches lay next to each other as a pieces of mosaic. Mosaic methodologies search for alternative limited and contextual methodologies, which potential is endless. When methodologies are recognized as many physical, material, and spiritual sites, they also brought closer to the human and non-human lives and materialities of these entangled spaces. Life-maintaining and communal methodologies of the South, and potentially consuming and possessive individualistic methodologies of the North, come together, various hesitant but important ways. We desperately need more methodological sites outside the North America, and qualitative research practices needs geographical decentering. As we further consider critical qualitative research that focuses on the complexities of justice matterings, the politics of research cannot be denied. Escobar provides a vantage point from which research can be approached as a political practice. He envisions a relational future which entails a study decentering and displacement of the capital economy, decentering the representative democracy and settling into the place of direct, autonomous, and communal forms of democracy. In this kind of methodological world, methodological development is no longer the organizing principle, but rather a variety of experiences and strategies are considered valid. Methodological processes are always under construction, and criticality of our worlds and scholarship is a relational task and an important imperative. More specifically, this alternative world, the pluriverse, would carry forward epistemic decolonization, alternatives to methodological development, transitions to the post-extractivism and notions of a civilization crisis and communal logic and more. The current methodological crisis, if you will, has to do with specific kinds of world-making practices and fundamental methodological dualism. More so, dualism itself is not the problem, but hierarchies established around the binaries and hierarchical classification of difference shape our practices in problematic ways. Enacting non-binary and flat methodologies could be seen as a requirement for transformation and radical change. Healing of our fragmented methodological past and ontological practice by acknowledging hurt feelings and emotion could serve as one point of a relationality. And then about methodological, a little bit more about methodological future. Escobar encourages us to think of the act, process, and design of futures, futuring. In this context, methodological futuring. Methodological futuring can design themselves and work through breakdowns. It could be argued that the field of cultural inquiry does not have methodological problems, but methodological breakdowns. Methodological breakdowns bring to the forefront our current practices and tools. Some of these breakdowns might be anticipated, and the inefficiency of current methodological tools offers opportunities for creation, experimentation, and invention. The shift from problems to breakdowns also position knowing as relating and highlights connections rather than taking distance from the problems. How might methodological sustainable futuring and productive breakdowns function? I agree with CI, who problematizes progress and development, especially since methodological progress and development doesn't always lead to democracy, but potentially to various forms of violence and oppression. There is no objectivity that can determine other people's position and what they need. Socialization and economic planning are not necessary keys to the better world, CI explains. A vision of different mathematical world could include multiple relational, political, and operational scenarios. For example, existing mathematical rules could be changed at any time. All scholars could modify rules and mathematical processes based on comparable consequences. Scholars would be able to leave mathematical communities without exploitation and exclusion. Dependency on specific kind of scholarly connections and citations would need to be reconsidered. So mathematical disciplinary dependence does not limit alternatives and make it impossible to leave the field practice and move across disciplines and subdisciplines. Focus would be shifted from the politics of discipline towards the politics of relationships. These kind of scenarios might also mean that we need to unlearn various forms of hierarchical organization and expand our theories of free mathematical connectivity and relationality. What if objects and materiality could provoke thinking doing without being themselves thought? What if we could create diverse methodologies that protect and restore ecologies? What if everyday life would serve as a context for methodological experiments? What if we could support more place-based and globally networked methodologies? What if we might utilize more emergent encounters, participatory solutions, and processes? What if qualitative inquiry would build on continuously changing and diverse transdisciplinary knowledges and minor practices? What if there are no more of the same, but scholars explore more frequently the impossible? What if the field of qualitative inquiry rotates methodological applications and responsibilities? What if qualitative inquiry promotes diverse communities of radical methodologies? If light makes vision possible, I would like to end with one additional alternative title for this presentation. Other methodologies are possible and new methodological sensibilities are on their way. It is time to dim our lights and sense the invisible. Thank you. And just hold on a sec.
Thank you so much, Mirka, for your inspiring and thought-provoking talk. It's always, you always leave me with a lot to process. So we are lucky that we have two fabulous respondents this evening to help us process and think through some of what you presented us with. So our first discussant is Dr. Aaron Kuntz. Dr. Kuntz.
Great, thank you. Oh geez, you turn on the Zoom video and I feel like I'm staring at my driver's license photo, which isn't a great thing. So my apologies in advance. Well, thanks so much for the paper and for inviting me to respond. I'd like to thank, of course, Mirka for this provocative paper. My mother always told me that I don't listen well, and she's right. So it was a delight to have the paper in material form as I engaged with the ideas and to see, I was privileged enough to see some drafts as it went through. So it's really neat to see how things processed. So there's much to engage within this paper and Mirka's work more generally. So for the sake of time, I think I'll focus in on notions of experimentation, plurality, and ethical engagement in somewhat entangled order, and offer a sense of inquiry as an experimental way of making the just, imbued with an ethical force for change. I'll begin by offering two overarching questions that this talk provoked for me. Question one, what are the problems to which speculative experimentations respond or engage? Or question two, what problems are made possible through speculative experimentation? What breakdowns are enabled? So these questions arise because problems and practices and strategies are productively entangled. As Deleuze and Guattari note, all concepts are connected to problems without which they would have no meaning. And so I wonder about how the very notion of speculative experimentations are connected to problems in particular contexts. One potential issue might have to do with the anxiety-inducing problem of chaos, anxiety for me anyways, that if we have no definitive future nor defined present, then we live in a chaotic world. And speculative and experimental practices only amplify that multiplicity. Importantly, Elizabeth Gross notes that chaos need not be understood as absolute or complete disorder, but in her words, rather as a plethora of orders, forms, wills, forces that cannot be distinguished or differentiated from each other. It's for me, it's the blurring of definition that manifests chaos, the overabundance of order, not its absence. So perhaps this is part of the affective sadness or worry that permeates some work today, and creeps, I think, into Mirka's words, that we have too much order, we have too much form, too much will, the excess of which overwhelms and chaos ensues. As Rosie Bradotti notes, this, in her terms, too muchness is one of the sources of exhaustion, which marks so much of our current predicament and ultimately brings about a shrinkage of our ability to take in and on the world that we are in, simply because it hurts too much to take in and on. So we perhaps turn to experimental engagements with this too muchness, this excess that exhausts, which brings its own problems, of course, and that's a good thing. So on experimentation, I'm not creative, never claimed to be, at least not in the conventional sense of the term. I can't sing, or I can, but my singing does not meet even the most progressive claims of aesthetic worth. I'm also not a visual artist. As such, things such as experimental inquiry approaches often simultaneously astound me, scare me, move me, and close me off from engagement, a multiplicity of effects, indeed. If I am creative, I suppose it is through a sense of conceptual creativity that I have manifest through an ongoing engagement with philosophy. Again, I turn to Elizabeth Gross, who considers philosophy the wayward sibling of art, a kinship as both enactments emphasize a degree of experimentalism as a means to create new relations, new problems, a future not yet created. As Gross so eloquently writes, I love this phrasing she has, twin rafts over chaos, philosophy and art, along with their more serious sibling, the sciences, enframe chaos, each in its own way, in order to extend something consistent, composed, imminent, which it uses for its own ordering and also deranging resources. There's a doubleness here, right? Of course, that calls forth the productive potential and reduction of philosophy, art, and science. In one sense, each allows for a means to encounter chaos in meaningful ways. In another sense, such processes of ordering might well lead to a taming of difference, a closing off of potential in order to allow for things to, well, make sense. And so as we engage with Marcus provocations, wondering what methodologies become possible when we dim the lights, I wonder about what might orient us, how we might enact an eminent positioning that is not dependent on the prolific ordering of a past, yet does not reinscribe pure relativism through derangements either. This is a question, I think, of ethics. And I wonder about the potential for our inquiry work to think the just, as Michel Foucault termed it, or more deliberately, inquiry as a means to make the just. Because for Foucault, thinking the just requires an overt political stance that begins with an ethical positioning, a determination that normalized governing processes are untenable. Further, thinking, as Deleuze notes, means to experiment and to problematize. Thus, thinking the just begins with an act of experimental refusal, no longer abiding by the claims of convention, and entails an imminent making. Thinking the just thus becomes making the just, and making the just might articulate as a process of entangling an ethical determination to produce a difference with an orienting belief in another future potential, that we might become differently through different relations, animated by different forces within a materially generative world. I'm interested in inquiry as making the just because I sense within Mirka's work an ethical commitment, one that emphasizes an affirmative ethical engagement with potential and a determination to experiment with that potential, to speculate on what might yet become. So hers would seem to be more than a neutral stance on what is to be done. This is important to note in contemporary work that engages with flattened hierarchies. How does one enact an ethical engagement with the world amidst such flattening? Indeed, a flattened hierarchical perspective is often critiqued for its political naivete and refusal to acknowledge histories of asymmetrical relations of power. That is, some would argue that flattening traditional hierarchies conveniently erase historical contexts that disproportionately govern some groups and privilege others. Such a perspective may conveniently overlook a legacy of exploitative relations that are only extended through a dismissal of material hierarchy. In short, it is quite possible that the rush to lay claim to rhizomatic expressions of flattened hierarchies extends from a privilege of not experiencing a legacy of power claims on one's person. As such, this theoretical embrace of a dispersed system stems from privileges gained from conventional hierarchies and systems of power. Such context situates even the most well-intentioned critique as a reformist in order, born from and reinscribing the very exploitative relations they claim to disrupt. As an alternative, a materialist critique might complicate the smoothing of conventional hierarchies for what Thomas Nail terms a twisted ontology in which different regions of matter are unevenly developed and circulated. This twisted ontology remains vital to considerations of exploitation and material inequity that seem to have fallen out of theoretical favor of late. Our contemporary moment is rife with uneven material agencies, and that unevenness matters. Further, our inquiry work certainly has a generative role in twisting ontologies, locating some ways of living as important for recognition, even critique, and excluding others. As a consequence, it remains important to locate those uneven, exploitative relations, map their intersections, even exclusions, and consider their effect on ontological levels. As a practice of transgression, inquiry might articulate as a type of challenge from within. One inhabits a limit in order to manifest a transgression. Because limits always hold the material for transgressive potential, experimental inquiry uses the condition of limits to manifest their rupture, enacting a future yet unknown. Recognizing the symbiotically productive relations of limits and transgressions shifts the intention and work of the inquirer. It's not simply enough to strive to break a limit. One must use the material of the limit to generate something else. This is a creative or experimental relation to limits, one that manufactures difference where once there was only repetition. Such it is that inquiry must be decidedly materialist in order to generate transgressions through governing limits. One must discern and intervene within the material conditions that make our governance possible. And this work begins from a place of ethical determination that our present exploitative relations are untenable. We cannot bear them anymore. Transgressive change extends from the very sensation of living then through the material world. In her provocative book entitled What Comes After Entanglement, Eva Gerard advocates for an ethical engagement with exclusion, recognizing, in her words, the entities, practices, and ways of being that are foreclosed when other entangled realities are materialized. This perspective aligns with the notion of twisted ontologies I spoke of earlier, as one locates those becomings that are short-circuited by the layered buildup that occurs when some ontological formations are twisted together, governed into relation, and others are necessarily excluded. The landscape of twisted ontologies is one of uneven development and exclusion. Some relations are deemed to matter more than others, and the processes of such mattering requires ethical deliberation and an emergent sense of responsibility. As Gerard goes on to write, attention also needs to be paid to the frictions, foreclosures, and exclusions that play a constitutive role in the composition of lived reality. Centralizing and politicizing these exclusions is vital in carving out space for intervention. Examining rational exclusions as constitutive of our contemporary moment is an ethical act of inquiry for Gerard, one that generates the conditions necessary for intervention. And for Gerard, those constitutive fictions, frictions, foreclosures, and exclusions serve as an important and often theoretically overlooked entry point for material analysis. More than the density of the entanglements themselves, it is their limits, those spaces where identified relations fade into necessary exclusions, that provide opportunities for ethical engagement, deliberation, and contingent action. Thus it is that experimental inquiry necessarily enacts acts of difficult recognition. We are bound by and responsible for these tragic circumstances. Belief, we might be otherwise. And virtue, we must become differently. Experimental inquiry is, in short, an ethically laden making, a means of generating the just in circumstances that overwhelm through perpetuating injustice. This might bring us to a series of provocative, I think, questions that Colin Koopman asks, and I think extend from Mirka's work. Here are the questions. What are the problems we cannot but feel the force of? Over what and why are we constantly anxious and inevitably distraught? What are the problems with which we wrap and warp our lives in burning intensities? In many ways, I remain emboldened through Braidotti's notion that we practice a pragmatic engagement with the present in order to collectively construct conditions that transform and empower our capacity to act ethically and produce social horizons of hope or sustainable futures. For me, inquiry is part and parcel of such resistive and productive practice. This is inquiry as an ontological way of living, motivated by ethical force, a way of reading the future into the present, to borrow the phrasing of J.K. Gibson Graham. And Mirka's work reminds us, this can be joyful experimentation, an exuberant experimental engagement with the not yet. And similarly, as Foucault admonished, do not think that one has to be sad in order to be militant, even though the thing one is fighting is abominable. Through inquiry, we engage with the present as a Deleuzian amnesic witness, blurring the governing processes and practices of fascism such that they lose their precise purpose, creating relational conditions through which specific forms of resistive potential become anew. Through inquiry, we might engage the present to break its violent hold on our very being, utilizing the circumstances that enforce our exhaustion such that we might become otherwise. Through inquiry, we stand vigil, lookouts for potential change, refusing the governing limitations of the status quo and using the material of our contemporary moment to generate a transformative difference. My thanks to Marco's paper for helping to provoke these thoughts and to all of you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Aaron. That's such an exciting response. I'm like all jazzed up now after hearing Mirka and hearing you. I'm really looking forward to this being on the podcast so that we can revisit and re-listen and continue to learn. So Mirka, would you like me to try to play the video? Okay. So our next response is from Dr. Swarante and I am going to do my best to share a YouTube video. And play. All right. Perfect.
Thank you, Mirka, for your mind-provoking talk and for inviting me to comment on it. It's been my great pleasure to follow your career and success over the years. And here are my comments. Just like you put it in your speech, global anti-capitalist perspective is necessary if we are to survive as a species. During the past year, a virus known as COVID-19 halted the world. It's a biological fact that we cannot wish away, but it has had tremendous social and political consequences worldwide. We cannot change the mechanisms the virus works and mutates. But like navigators who sense the strength of the wind and its direction, we can take those laws into account in our actions. Neglecting them can result in a fatal multi-organism disease, like a mistake in navigation can cause a shipwreck. Therefore, I must sail the ship and take the storm caused by the virus into account in at least two ways. First, I may reason that life is dangerous in any case, continue to meet people and ignore possible consequences for my health. Second, I can think that health is vital and therefore I want to follow safety measures, wash my hands, keep social distance, and wear a mask. As I cannot escape the fact of COVID-19, I still have the freedom to choose what effects I allow it to have on me and my actions. Besides, by following the necessary safety measures, I take care of myself and my fellow beings, and by doing so, carry my collective responsibility. Indeed, many have had to consider how to live, not to become infected or infect others. The recommendations of health experts have been clear, but humans are not machines. They take the official measures in their judgment and relate them to the totality of their individual lives. The weighing of these options on human decision and meaning-making interests me as a qualitative researcher and a social scientist. The options can be seen in a continuum where, at the other end, people live their lives as usual, and at the other, follow safety measures quite literally. The rationales and logics for these options vary. Perhaps the most exciting answers come from the unresponsible and individualistic risk takers who utter, "Yes, of course, there is a risk of infection, and it makes me think, but even then." The philosopher G.H. von Wright has presented a general model of action in which he distinguishes the result and consequence of an act. On the one hand, the result of the act of opening a window is that a certain window is open. These consequences are states of affairs which, by virtue of causal necessity, come about when the act has been done. On the other hand, a consequence of the act of opening a window may be that the temperature in the room goes down. Or, as the Finnish poet Pentti Saarikoski writes about a possible consequence, the bird could fly in. What makes the logic of human action and decision-making related to the COVID-19 so special is their collective nature. My individual decisions are associated with a tight global network of others' choices. The post-pandemic time will finally tell if the window has been open or closed, and how many black COVID-19 ravens have flown in. The black ravens can enter the neoliberal university too, in these precarious times. In the social sciences unit, we managed to transform our teaching online early on. Even during the pandemic, my workplace, Tampere University, succeeded to produce enough degrees to fulfill its promise to the Ministry of Education and Culture, the largest funder of the universities in Finland. We had proven to be good academic workers, perhaps too good, for the success came at a price. The Tampere University's campus plan, approved by the university board in fall 2020, states that, and I quote, "The experience gained through the COVID-19 pandemic highlights the need for flexible learning and working solutions, in particular, where digital and physical environments merge to support the users' daily lives and well-being." Quote ends. In addition, the plan includes the promise, and I quote, "Tampere University's goal is to be carbon neutral by 2030. As part of the target, its office and teaching spaces will be reduced by 25%. Quote ends. I guess no one sees anything wrong with the carbon neutrality, but many made the math and calculated 1 plus 1, equaling that the university would eliminate our faculty building. In fact, carbon neutrality may be mere smoke and mirrors, the true reason being cost savings under the neoliberal regime. The campus plan in our university is another example of the new management university, managerial capitalist university. To add insult to injury, due to the COVID-19 restrictions on the campus, the university managers could launch the plan without fearing that we teachers and students occupy the university building, as we did a few years ago. Consequently, it's possible that we lose our office spaces, seminar rooms, lecture halls, and more importantly, our sense of community, and perhaps turn into digital nomads without any other social existence than our digital presence. Many might feel betrayed. Maybe we managed to do our job too well and won the race to the bottom. The capitalist neoliberal university, as the world, doesn't seem to follow the proverb, "The harder you work, the luckier you get," but quite reverse. Perhaps tomorrow we don't say that video killed the radio star, but that digital shift ate our office space. In the future, We might not teach in the shadow of the COVID-19 anymore, or under the mango tree as Paulo Freire. In Finland, it's too cold for that. But carry on our solitary talk only in the digital sphere. I do know the world out there is much, much grittier and uglier than this, and the ills of the world are vast. But God is in detail. We cannot take our position as educational and social scientists for granted anymore. For it's not only the managerial university that is after the critical scholar, but also the news media. Believe it or not, we have only one national newspaper in Finland, Helsingin Sanomat, plus few other regionals. A couple of days ago, Helsingin Sanomat published an editorial in which one of the editors in chief stated as follows, and I quote, "The farther one goes from the core of science to the social, humanistic, and ultimately artistic research, the less empirical evidence there is in academic competition and the more ideological the research becomes." The editor then shared the editorial on Twitter and wrote, "It seems that this editorial has raised diverse debate. The speculative assumption in the text was that academic competition would seem to have a greater tendency to become idealized when there are no clear criteria in the field to compare theories. Ideologized, to become ideologized, yes, when there are no clear criteria in the field of, to compare theories." Quote ends. A sociologist then asked, and I quote, "I continue your speculation by asking, what is, in your view, the clear criteria to compare those theories in science lacking in social sciences, which prevents the power of ideologies?" The editor replies, "Scientific method." Then the philosopher of science intervenes. "Would you like to tell us what is this scientific method?" We philosophers of science, despite many attempts, haven't been able to find one. This was also a quote. It seems to me that the powerful national media outlet's mighty editor has aligned with the populist right, the conservative right, the racist right, and the Nazis. And we have had our wake-up call in so many places, in the biological, psychological, social, and political spheres. We cannot stay in our compartments any longer. We need what Mirka was talking about, pluriversity. We need to join forces. As Mirka and Fred Poateng put it in a few years back, and I quote, this quote ends my comments, "Scholars need to stop engaging in research activities for research's sake only. Research needs to serve the public, citizens, students, parents, teachers, and so on. Social science research should be a collaborative effort and a form of public science. It's time to consider how to increase methodological attentiveness and the potential of collaborative inquiry that builds on collective yet contradictory stories, abstract and material life experiences. Thank you so much and congratulations, Mirka. La lucha continua."